I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and lo, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and lo, there was no one at all, and all the birds of the air had fled. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all its cities were in ruins before the Lord, before his fierce anger. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of my poor people not been restored? Oh, that my head were a spring of water, my eyes a fountain of tears, so that I might weep day and night for the slain of my poor people. We're going to take a look at some of the communal or community dynamics that have to do with racism in our series this week, and see at least if in broad brushstrokes we might begin to catch a glimpse of new possibility in community relationships, and at least discern some clues as to how we might move beyond the power of racism. But quickly, I want to cover some old ground for some of us, for the new folks, so that we might have a little bit of a common beginning point. And I would invite any of you who are interested to, in your spare moments, such as they might be, to catch some of the tapes from our sessions last week. You might find them helpful simply in building a common frame of reference. Certainly what we do in relation to racism this week is not going to be exhaustive, and at the same time we hope that it's not abstract. We want to touch life issues. We want to touch issues that come from our experience. Also, we're not going to resolve in these five sessions the challenge of racism. Maybe we'll catch some glimpses, maybe some practical insights that we can put to use, and maybe we'll find ourselves called to account personally, and in the midst of that experience a bit of freedom relative to moving beyond the grip of a common demon in our lives. I think that we're interested in informing ourselves about some of the factors which influence behavior and some of the ways that we can release people from old patterns, and then maybe do some initial strategizing regarding our communities and toward being a little bit more inclusive in our community patterns and relationships. One of the things that we suggested to people in the last session was that racism in our life as a nation, and as a matter of fact in the lives of several nations around the world right now, that racism is a persisting demonic presence, that it is not an old problem, it is a present problem, and that it is a present problem that does not even really depend upon whether you or I experience ourselves as personally prejudiced against these people or those people, although I suspect that in all of our experiences we'll find that there are those deep prejudices that maybe even are buried very deeply. We shared with the group last week a model of racism that we find helpful, kind of like a plastic overlay. We're not trying to suggest that this is all racism is about, but we found it a helpful way of beginning to think about some of the dynamics in our society that we might call racism. Now, it has been said that people of color in this society cannot be racist. I don't know if you agree with that. That is not to say that people of color cannot be prejudiced, but that is to suggest that there is a dimension of racism which is peculiar to the European American population that perhaps belongs uniquely to those of us in the European American population. Or to put it another way, we white folks. Many people have suggested that being white or whiteness is really a matter of mentality. It's a frame of mind. It's attitudinal. It does not really have to do with objective realities, but it does have to do with historical events and has to do with where we live in terms of our consciousness. So the model of racism that we find helpful is that racism is a sociological reality, and it is a spirit force. It has to do with prejudice, personal and communal. You may have noticed that our personal prejudices sort of arise out of a communal stew. That is, that we're in conversation, sort of in the deeps with others, that reinforce our prejudices. Also has to do with discrimination. That is to do, it has to do with action that may flow out of prejudices. But then prejudices are reinforced, and in some instances perhaps even called into being by discriminatory behavior. But then it also has to do with a third sociological dimension, which really sort of puts the juice into it from the perspective at least of the European American community. What might that be? If you got prejudice and discrimination, you still really don't have racism unless you have a third term. What is that?
Segregation?
Certainly that would be part of it, wouldn't it? And that would be perhaps a pattern of discrimination. What do you have in order to enforce segregation?
Power.
Law.
Power. Yes, indeed. Power. And of course, that's not an insight that we can claim. Many folks have begun to discern that power is the dynamic that is present in our society, which makes racism a white problem. Now, it is a reality that holds us all in its grip, people of color as well as European Americans. And it may be that before we finish this series, that distinction won't even be helpful any longer. But it holds us all in its grip. But the key factor is power, which makes it clear that this is a white problem, not a problem of people of color, save that they have to live with the power that is ours to wield and that we may even not be aware that we participate in. It has to do with privilege. Privilege that we've learned to take for granted, that others do not in our society. But then it's not simply a sociological reality. It is also a spirit force. And by that I would mean at least that it's a mode of consciousness. It has to do with a myth or a deep story about identity out of which flows an understanding of ourselves that is articulated as racial superiority. And in many instances it may be very, very, very deep, but it's been there throughout all of our history as this nation, but then as other nations in America also. It's not only a mythology, however, it's also rituals or little liturgies that are enacted socially that reinforce the myth of racial superiority. I suspect the tomahawk chop is one of those little rituals that would not be recognized as discrimination, but it reinforces in a subtle way the myth of racial superiority by trivializing a non-European culture. And then finally, there are symbols that have a great deal of power that have to do with whiteness and being white, that mediate or communicate the story about identity. And you know, it's really interesting. We noticed when we moved to St. Paul about 7 years ago that the great divide in our community was not in the first instance racial or color. You had to look a little deeper to understand that it was color. We saw, for example, that middle-class black families could live most anywhere they wanted to. But there was a little game that they learned how to play very well. They learned how to be white. And as long as they played that game, there was no difficulty. But then the others, and then it seemed like a matter of class and poverty. There were many people that lived in the small inner city of St. Paul who did not play the game. And there was a great deal of anger boiling away under the surface. So it seems to us that this is a model that is at least suggestive in terms of understanding the complex and ambiguous presence of racism as a persisting evil, if I might say, in our society. Now, how many of you are from Canada? Anybody here from Canada? Okay, good. Most of our illustrations will be drawn from our experience in the United States. But that is not to say that the realities we've tried to get a hold of are not true also for our brothers and sisters in Canada, as well as in Mexico and throughout the Americas. I suspect that in Canada you may have particular challenges around your Native American population, which by and large are an invisible population in Canada. And then also, as one of our participants last week pointed out, there is certainly, in terms of ethnic divide in Canada right now, that which takes the most attention is between French Canadians and British Canadians. But then there's a mosaic of other peoples that have moved in, and the population of Canada is beginning to diversify dramatically, as you know. And so we would welcome any insights and comments from you that help us understand even more clearly these dynamics in terms of the realities of Canada. Now this week, yes?
That's a general system which would also apply to, in slightly different ways, to sexism,
sure,
ethnocentricity,
certainly
differences
would.
Of language. So that
certainly would.
In Canada it would be, in Ireland for instance, in the Republic of Ireland it would be the attitude against Protestants, and the Northern Ireland,
yes,
attitude against Catholics.
Right, right. And certainly those isms tend to bind together like a tangled skein in the sort of the subsoil of our lives. And one of our colleagues pointed out to us that in terms of the pulpit, for example, in the ELCA, the racism and sexism especially reinforce one another. And so there comes a time in many congregations where somebody's going to have to force the issue, mm-hmm, that we are to see women and people of color in our pulpits. Yes?
I was thinking how well that also would apply, for example, to tribalism.
Huh.
The conflicts in,
yes,
Minneapolis.
Yes, indeed.
It's the same,
yes,
bundle of stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yes, and some of us had a conversation several months ago with George Farrell, I think his name is, a Lutheran theologian. And he was relating to us his deep anxieties about what he sees as the upsurge of tribalism in the world today. And he pointed especially to places like Yugoslavia and some of the former Soviet republics as a way of seeing that there's something breaking loose around the globe that is not dissimilar to the old demon that we've lived with in our history. That's very deeply related, and it's fracturing and splintering people and rending the fabric of society. Now this week, our sessions, these are our poetic titles. We never really quite know what's going to happen in the session when we start talking and touching on issues that really cut to the quick in our lives. But in this first session today, we want to take a look at personal and community identity and how that relates to diversity or otherness. And then the second session tomorrow on Tuesday, we want to take a look at images and behavior and how our mental pictures determine and influence our behavior. And what are the subtle messages that either reinforce or contradict the pictures that we live out of other people in the world. And then on Wednesday, we want to spend a bit of time working on some approaches that we call it rendering stereotypes obsolete. In one sense, the stereotypes that we have personally and communally are probably going to be with us all of our lives. And so the question comes, how do you let the air out? So they can just lie there on the ground as we go on about our business. And then on Friday, we want to take a look at pathways of change and begin to think together about pressure points in our communities that we might begin to think strategically about in helping to reinforce and foster a new sense of community. And then finally, on Saturday morning, spend a bit of time dealing together on building diversity, or how do we begin to build inclusive communities that help us move beyond racism. So that's at least poetically and in broad strokes where we want to spend our time. And we're very clear after our experience last week that a one-hour session is a fairly limited conversation. So we're going to be around all week, and we certainly would welcome continuing conversations with all of you about some of the issues that we try to unpack and uncover and deal with. And so invite that, and understanding that we're always a bit rushed in the one-hour formal session. And so if there's something burning away in you want to talk with us about, then grab us after the session is finished. Now, to dive into this morning's session, beg your pardon?
Quickly,
yes. we're doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good on time. I've still got a few minutes left. To dive into this morning's session, we're going to take a look first. I don't need to erase this yet. at, oh, let's say communal realities. In America today, what is our sense of community? Well, if somebody was to ask you, what makes up community? What is it that enables people to understand themselves as a community together? What would you say are some of the characteristics of community?
Common values.
Common values, underscore common. Okay, common values, what else?
High school sports team.
Pardon?
High school sports team.
High school sports team, so common experiences, common, okay.
History.
History, mm-hmm. Probably a common history.
Sense of responsibility for the other members.
Yeah. Okay, a sense of responsibility for the other members, certainly. Yes?
Strangely enough, common language.
Common language, certainly, underscore common, again, yes. Right. One of the striking things about most of our experiences of community, see if I can spell this right, has to do with homogeneity. Doesn't that mean sameness? Now, I'm a Lutheran. I'm a fairly new Lutheran. I've been a member of a Lutheran congregation 7 years. But I understand from talking to my colleagues in Minnesota that in times past, among the Lutheran community in Minnesota, diversity meant that you had Swedes and Danes getting together in the same town.
Yep.
And maybe throw in a Norwegian or two, and then here come the German. I mean, that's diversity. Not to mention the Irish that live up in St. Paul, or that little Welsh community down in southwestern Minnesota. And that's diversity. Well, homogeneity, relatively speaking, is most of our experience in terms of community. And we tend to expect people in our community to be folks who share sameness, values, language, experiences, even historical events and memory, historical memory. So that there's a sense of expectation of sameness in what we mean generally in America by community. Isn't that interesting? But that's the case. One of the things that's led to is if we were to image the way that we've structured community. We've structured community several different ways. There were those experiences of community where, of course, the majority lived here, and there was this little minority here, and we had a steel fence between us, separate but equal. And then, of course, there are, you know, other experiences of community where the majority of us lived here, and then there was this little community that really was in a separate universe. That was the Native Americans in the reservation 20 miles down the road. And then, of course, there was a view of community that was something like this, and, you know, there were people that, well, they're part of our community. There's the Mexican Americans, and maybe the Chinese or the Japanese. Of course, we don't mention the wire fence that we built between them and us. But all of these sort of variety of perspectives of the way we built community has been our experience of homogeneity in America. Now, there's a lot to be said about that more. But I want to suggest that in terms of what's happening in the world today, there are some new realities we need to come to terms with, and maybe in a sense they've always been part of our experience of community. Mentioned the other day to folks that in the year 2000, only 1 out of 5 people entering our workforce in the United States will be white male. Only 1 out of 5. All of us white males in the room, I see that most of us are sort of getting up in years a bit. We're not going to be too common in the new workforce that's emerging in the United States. The other 4 out of 5 will be people of color and women. There's a new reality, really, that is ours in the United States and other parts of the world, including Canada. Our population is changing. Sometime in the next century, maybe before the midpoint of the century, the majority of the population in this nation will be those whom now we call people of color. Now, we very easily use terms like majority population and minority. Who are the minorities?
Right.
Who are the minorities?
In California, that's a big debate because shortly white European Americans will be a majority of minorities, but not exactly a minority.
Majority of minorities.
There'll be a majority of minorities and we'll be the smallest, the largest of the minorities.
Yes. We've inherited that language, of course, from our European cousins. And, of course, that had to do especially with the European political process and the parliamentary system. What are the implications of a term like minority? If you belong to a minority, what do you understand that means in relation to the majority?
You'll never vote through your agenda.
Powerlessness. Yes, indeed. Powerlessness. Some of our friends, and my wife may have a very impassioned little short course to share with you sometime this week, suggest that that language is passé. Mm-hmm. And people of color certainly don't like it. Because it suggests powerlessness. And of course, in terms of the world scene, who's in the minority?
We are.
We of the paler skin are. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Well, so what does all this mean? If we've got new realities and yet our experience of community is homogeneity, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, we want to share with you an image that we have found helpful in beginning to think and talk about the experience of identity and community. You'll recognize it. What is that picture?
Yin-yang.
That's the yin-yang. Yes. From Taoism, and of course many other religions have used it also. What does it suggest to you, just looking at it? Just sort of quick reflections. What does that suggest to you?
Equality.
All right, there's something about equality there. What else?
Tension and balance.
Tension and balance. That's interesting, isn't it? The Oriental notion of harmony is not what we usually think of as harmony. It does not have to do with the absence of tension. It has to do with balanced tension. Do you see movement in that picture?
Mm-hmm.
Balanced tension. How is it that I come to grasp who I am as a human being? Well, certainly it's by being around others like myself and having models that I can look to that demonstrate certain kinds of behavior and values. But then finally, I don't grasp what it means for me to be male until I have to be over against female. I don't grasp what it means to me for me to be white until I have to live with a person of color or go to school with persons of color or work with persons of color. That is to suggest that the experience of otherness is deeply, deeply a part of what it means to grasp my own identity. Personally, and we want to suggest this has implications even for community. Now, what does that mean? Well, what I discover is that in the midst of relating to my wife as woman, I discover within myself a bit of femininity. I discover in relating to my wife that I am also feminine. I discover in relating to my wife, who's African American, something within me that that resounds with her experience. And she discovers the same. Now, but that doesn't necessarily describe simply intimate relationships like the marriage relationship. What we're suggesting is that it has to do with the tangled tension of creating identity within group relationships and so on. I think this is why a number of our homosexual friends find it very important that they find a way of relating with authenticity to people who are straight. Has to do with identity. And that underscores, for me, the cruciality of some of our congregations that have become reconciled in Christ in terms of daring to experiment with authentic community. Now, we want to talk a great deal about the implications of this image, what this might mean for community in the rest of the week, but wanted to this morning share this image with you as a clue relative to identity and the possibility of forging new communities. Racism has underlined, is that the correct term, underlain or underlined? anyway, has been present in all of our experiments with forming community. We've got to figure out how we forge new communal patterns that reflect a new mentality, and that in turn reinforce and give birth to a new mentality. And we've chosen the term diversity. Others talk about inclusivity or multicultural. We can invoke all those terms this week. But that's kind of where we want to work this week and continue to reflect on racism and then the theme or the motif of new community and diversity. Now, I've used up all my time, haven't I?
Yes.
When I look at that, we look at it as equality, but in my mind, I can make one stand out over the other.
Uh-huh.
But I can also change that.
Yes.
So then.
Interesting, isn't it? And what's also interesting is that the metaphor suggests unity. Difference in the midst of unity. Unity that is inclusive of difference, of otherness. What's our experiential reaction to otherness? Generally.
We don't like it. We reject
it. It frightens us.
But
yes.
3 years ago, Peter Steinke was talking here, and he said that the basic psychological attitude, he says, people have is that when we're a child, we walk away from our mother and we come back to her.
Uh-huh.
And this underlies all of our human experiences. So to become a human being is to move away from home and back to home. And this is simply one illustration of this, that to grow up means to reach out to those challenges and then to retreat back. And that constant interplay is what makes us what we are.
That's very interesting. It certainly is a crucial dynamic. But I like especially the motif of journey that's in that dynamic. I think some people may not want to put as much credence on the figure of mother and so on, but nonetheless, the motif of journey and movement is very, very important.
I'm ready.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've got too much time.
Yes. We want to take a few minutes and reveal how we relate to this business of diversity. And we're going to have two lists up here, and you're going to generate the information for us and for yourself as we talk about it and look at the ways we have structured ourselves consciously and unconsciously.
You've got to turn it vertically. Yes.
Right on. Anyway, as he's getting the sheets up, I want us to talk a little bit about the kinds of groups, racial groups, that we're aware of. And as you call those out, he's going to put those on the sheet for us. And in your different communities that you would say are racial groups, anyone, what are some of the racial groups in your communities?
Hispanics.
Native Americans.
Filipino.
Not too fast. Filipino, you said?
Yeah.
Norwegian.
Norwegian. Any other racial groups?
Oriental.
Japanese.
Chinese.
Should we say Asian? No.
Southeast Asian.
Southeast Asian. Hmong.
Vietnamese.
Southeast Asian,
Hmong.
Okay, you got
Vietnamese.
Okay.
Yeah. It's hard to say Asian anymore when you've got so many different ethnic groups of it. But we're gonna come to the ethnic part too.
They say Laotian,
Thai.
Okay. Laotian and Thai. Okay. Cambodian. Did you get that? And then you said.
The one I remember is that most of our refugees were ethnic Chinese who'd been in Vietnam for 250 years. But they were not Chinese from China, but they were Chinese. They were not Vietnamese, even though they spoke Vietnamese.
Right.
All right. We can add the ethnic group, but any other racial groups in your community? African American.
Oh. I don't know if this would go in there, but I recognize you go to church where there are light-skinned black people.
Yeah,
would that be a subgroup? Yeah, cool.
Well, you know, there was a time in our history nationally when it was. It's not now.
No, that's not, you have to see what they wanted to be called at one point. But basically, the roots are African American. Samoan?
Is there any reason why we wouldn't break down the Native American population?
No, say some. Sure.
Or Hispanic into Puerto Rican?
No reason. No.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you about the ethnic groups in your community in a minute.
Indians.
Okay.
There's a lot of them in Vancouver.
Caribbean people?
Huh?
It depends what they
have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You running out?
Yeah. What was the last one?
Caribbean.
Okay.
Haitians.
Okay.
Where do
Basques
come in?
Basques?
Basques?
The Basque people are
from
not people of color.
Well, but are you just putting, are we only talking about colored
now,
people here now?
She asked for racial.
You've only written down people you consider people of color.
She asked for racial.
Racial groupings.
Well, but
then
aren't white people racial groups?
Ethnic groups. Euro-Americans.
But I mean, you're specific, those are colored racial groups you're putting down there. Well, some of them are not colored, but they're mostly colored.
Right, on the racial groups.
Yeah, so this is racial
this
color group.
Right.
Yeah.
This time I'm going to ask for
well,
ethnic.
We didn't specify that. It's interesting, nobody.
But the ones we mentioned, you didn't put down there.
European-Americans.
European-Americans. Cultural groups, though, rather than races?
How do you define them?
You're going to see when we get a picture.
Last week we defined race. Go listen to the tapes.
How do you define the racial groups? But this list, you got out your racial groups. Now I want to add to that ethnic, what you would call ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
What would you call ethnic groups?
Greeks.
Italian.
Irish.
But some of us can't see what ethnic group we're from. I mean, that's kind of difficult.
Scandinavian.
It's a big melting pot. Mm-hmm. No, you're not really supposed to.
Oh, we're going to talk about that too.
Yeah, 116 of
everything.
Yeah. Go ahead. Any other ethnic groups?
Kenyans.
Okay.
There's actually tribes over there, but I don't know the names. Mandingos, there's a number of tribes that you could people who speak Swahili.
Okay.
French Canadians.
That's the Bantu.
French Canadians.
Bantu.
What did you say?
The Bantu is a collective.
French Canadians.
For those who speak Swahili.
And
Danes.
Bantu. Danes.
The Ita in Japan.
Yeah. Arabs.
Any other ethnic groups?
Well, every St. Patrick's Day, I just pretend I'm Irish.
Jewish? Yes, you can.
Yes. And last week, as we talked about the myth of racial identity, Jews usually were thought of as a separate race, at least in times past.
Now look, as you look at this list, both the racial and the ethnic groups. Now just think about this image of this. Someone already mentioned it here, this melting pot kind of thing. You remember that image of the melting pot? Who can just briefly describe that for us? What was that melting pot image for? What was it doing?
It's only for European Americans who melted.
Okay.
The Greeks and the Italians
all alike.
It was trying to make us all alike. We were kind of melting in a pot.
Well, but okay. There's probably 20 to 30 million Americans who go pass as whites who technically would go as colored under the old rules of the segregated states. There are people who just passed and their bloodstream is part of ours now, so that...
Alright, now, as you think about that image of the melting pot, which of these groups found it easiest to do the melting?
If you're pale, it's easier if you have white skin, because I mean, when
white skin,
the Northern Europeans, and Central Europeans,
mm-hmm. Central Europeans,
white skin, I think.
Why? Why was that?
Because you look alike.
Because you look alike. You can mix and you don't. You can't really like walk up to someone and say, "Well, I think you look Irish or Italian or something." It's hard to say.
Well, and therefore, our communities were shaped how?
In what shape?
What shape the communities in?
People who were like us. The ethnic groups, as soon as they took English as their language, they started to mix.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Before that, they didn't.
Okay.
When they were non-English, they were out. And when they became English, then they came into society.
If they had light skin.
Mm-hmm. Because what happened to the other groups, even if they took the English?
I think, you know, part of the melting pot also is a temporal or a time-oriented kind of. I mean, while we still use that term, I mean, it is a historical. I mean, it also belongs to history, and it was created quite a long time ago. And I would argue it like you're melting. You know, if you're literally melting like cheeses in a pot. I mean, at the time when I think that concept came into being. You basically had most of your immigrants were from European descent, except for, you know, slaves. You had a structurally, society had purposely segregated two communities. But I think, you know, if you start looking at a lot of the Asian, you know, communities that weren't purposely kept apart were melted together. And I think in that concept, it made a lot of sense that we were forcing people with similar. Or that we at least consider similar, whether it's because of pale skin or whatever, together, it may have outlived its usefulness in that once the melting pot looked pretty white, maybe it was harder to melt, you know, if we think we've started to break down some of these barriers, we didn't want to melt other stuff in because it looked too different.
Two melting pots.
That didn't come out right away, but I...
Well, we understand what you're...
But I think I'm saying the melting pot was a good concept for a historical time because all these other structures were in place to bound off what was going to be melted in and what wasn't going to be melted in.
Good for
it doesn't fit anymore, I think, because I don't think it's a useful one because in order to truly melt, the pot has to take the flavor of what's being put in, and I think there became too much inertia that said, this is our character, we'll only take things that are more of what we already have in and not new different things.
Yeah, but if
you want to become like what's in the pot, you're okay, but the pot won't become like what's going into
that's right.
It.
Right. Because who benefited from the melting pot?
You made an interesting comment about Asian people becoming melting in. From whose perspective did the Asian people?
I don't think they did. I think they were another group that was economically and otherwise separate. I was going to say that they weren't around, but then they really were in terms of like, particularly on the West Coast.
Yeah. Bill?
It also has to do with economic reality, because that melting pot image arose in the time of the industrialization period when there were all kinds of jobs and everybody could get them, and so they started coming together in the workforce, and that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
But was it really a melting pot? The Germans, they kind of maintained their German, the aspects of being German. The Irish, they kept theirs. You can still say that you were Irish, you were German, you were Swedish. I don't think there ever was a melting pot, really, in the United States. There was a pot. I've heard it talked of as a salad bowl, but if people really didn't melt everything. There's some of that you kind of got.
Well, that certainly is a shift. That certainly is a shift now.
But that's what you call someone like me who comes out of German, English, Irish, and French ancestry. I mean, something melted along the way.
One of the reasons the melting pot was lasted so long is that, for instance, I speak English and not Norwegian, but I know that 70 years ago there was an enormous fight around World War II to force people to get rid of the native language and speak English. Yeah. And having gone through that, I tend, down inside, to resent the idea that people of a different language will not learn English. Because I think that's something that obviously my ancestors went through, my parents remember it, and it's a certain thing that I feel, well, if we did it and it worked for us, why shouldn't it work for them too? And
well,
that pressure.
But why are we, if we're going to take speak in their language too. I mean, the only reason we really do that is make them learn our language, so it's easier for us, not for them. And I mean,
One last comment, then we got to shift to the other part of it.
You know, the melting pot concept was strong in people's minds in that a lot of immigrants did not want to retain their language like a lot of them do now. Mm-hmm. They wanted to speak English. Mm-hmm. Her parents deliberately didn't teach their children Swedish. Mine didn't teach. My mother didn't teach me Lithuanian.
Mm-hmm. And some of that is lost. I mean, it's part of the denial. Some of it's trying to assimilate. Some of it's trying to survive. We have all the reasons of why that could have happened. But I mean, it happened, and now we're faced with the fact of, oh my gosh, we've got all this diversity that we've slowly covered over because we were striving so hard to be part of the quote-unquote majority and everything else in order to go on in our society. But we want to shift to the other part of this brief workshop and continue to talk and think about what kinds of racial slurs do you recall about any of these groups? Racial slurs.
Think a minute while I write this up.
Yes.
They're hollering too fast.
All right. Racial slurs. Comments.
Racial and ethnic, or just racial?
Racial, about the groups. Racial slurs about the two racial groups and ethnic groups.
Okay.
Hold on.
Like
nigger?
Yes.
Yeah.
Who said that?
I wonder what helped her too. No. Go ahead. Yes, that's right. That's what I mean. What kind of racial slurs?
Okay, coon.
Coon. Think of all of them.
Kike.
Jigaboo. Wait a minute, that was one of
somebody said kike.
Kike.
Oh, yeah. Kike is a Jew.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, yeah, I just like to
show you. And what was yours?
And the other one.
Jigaboo was common in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
Squarehead.
Squarehead.
Honky.
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 Oh, really?
Mix.
Slanted eyes over here.
Mix.
And that was her.
Chink.
Chink.
Chap.
Wop.
Guineas.
Japs. What?
Guinea.
Guinea. Yes, indeed.
I know all. Honky.
Well,
it's a
honky.
No,
H-U-N-K-Y. Oh, okay.
What's a honky?
A bohunk.
In the East, they call Lithuanians hunkies.
Oh, really?
It's probably where they got the word honky.
Yeah.
Are we got trans.
We call Hungarians hunkies. Maybe not strictly racial, but wetback.
Wetback.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. All of them. Strictly racial.
Polacks.
Dago.
Yes. Who are the Dagos?
Italians.
Italians. Any others? What? Somebody said another one?
Strong. Yes. Who are the Pepsi?
Pepsi.
You're not French Canadian, are you?
Oh, no.
Pepsi is what the is a term used for French Canadians.
So it's from? Others.
Apple. Limey.
Limey and Hymie.
How about nips?
Nips. Yeah.
Japanese.
And then someone else
say it.
Apples.
Nipponese.
Apples.
What?
Apples.
Mm-hmm. Apples.
What's apples?
What?
People who are red on the outside, white on the
inside.
An Oreo cookie.
Oreos.
Devils.
What are devils?
Whites.
We have the scrubby Dutch in St. Louis. They were the Germans.
Scrubby?
Scrubby Dutch.
Scrubby Dutch.
Scrubby Dutch.
Stupid Swedes.
What did you say?
Stupid Swedes or dumb Swedes. We use them interchangeably.
Dumb Swedes?
Well, they got that because they wouldn't. They couldn't.
Are you familiar with the Durham Greaser?
Yeah. No, that's a motorcycle ride.
There was one.
Okies.
White trash.
Kicks.
What was that?
Yeah. Where I grew up, Yankee was one.
Oh, yeah. Yankee, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Considered by some people to be only half a word.
Yeah, an Indian one, Indian, for Indians.
Indian.
Oh, yeah, drunken Indian.
Drunken.
In the South, rednecks.
Ah, yes.
Engines.
Okay. Wasps.
What was that?
Wasps.
Wasps.
W-A-S-P.
Oh,
W-A-S-P.
White Anglo-Saxon.
What else?
Valleys. Like anybody who's from the valley.
Oh.
Valley.
Only one valley.
Valley.
For sure.
That's right.
Others.
What
do
we call
which?
Bogans? Yuppies.
Eccentrics.
Yuppies. I can't hear you.
Ragtop.
Oh. Step back, unless you want to add more. Step back and look at this list. Look at your group and look at the list. Look at the slurs. What strikes you about this?
Colorful.
Language. She said colorful language.
Yeah.
A lot of imagination to think
through
that.
I think it's pejorative, and it's deep in the language.
Pejorative?
Yeah,
nothing
very nice.
Categorizing?
Some of the words were accurate, and some of them started out, you know, that they're pejorative, mostly pejorative now, but they were not necessarily originally intended to be pejorative.
No, okay. Hold on the interpretation and evaluation. Just tell me what strikes you, like she gave me the others. We're going to get to that level.
They're ugly.
They focus on one characteristic, usually.
Yeah, or
okay.
single
characteristic, and that's it.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's physical, not what's inside the people.
Yeah. Can you tell anything from this? From this
individuality.
No individuality, no creativity. They're not worth knowing.
No.
Yeah.
Focusing on the differences.
Yeah.
Focus on the differences. And very strongly on a dehumanizing, mm-hmm. kind of degrading way. Now.
Yeah, they don't sound like people. It's like they're animals. It's not, they're not people. These aren't names for people.
Mm-hmm.
If they would be typically what a majority would apply to a minority mission. In other words, the fear factor or the
fear.
Something different, and you don't know what to call it or how to react and give it a funny name.
Okay. You were saying?
They're caricatures, they're real cartoonish.
Okay.
What about the names that minorities put on? Majorities, because the Native Americans called the early settlers in Puget Sound the Bostons. I mean, they made names too.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
And I bet.
Boston. Well, yes. Pushed away. Yeah. And you can do that with male female relationships too.
Mm-hmm. Beige chicks. We didn't put them down. We didn't have beige chicks boxes and stuff.
Yeah. If we were doing this workshop on mm-hmm. sexism,
right.
I'm sure that would come up and you could look at that exactly the same way. But thinking now, and coming to this other level of looking at this, what does this say to us about difference and diversity?
We don't like that.
We don't like it.
And we're afraid of it.
We can't accept it. It's like we can't accept it.
We minimalize it, trivialize it. We're afraid. Reveals our fear about it.
And also, although most people might feel of the same persuasion here, it still persists, and there's a lot of controversy. For example, the football team, the Redskins, the Washington Redskins,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of examples of that.
Oh, yeah.
See?
When you use these terms, it makes you feel superior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thing. Canadian Canucks. Mm-hmm.
My husband came from Denmark, and then he went into the Navy just about 2 years, I think, after he was here. He couldn't speak very good English, and they kept calling him a Swede. That made him so mad to be called a Swede. Because he would explain to him he was Danish, he was a Dane. Well, anyway, he started in athletics, you know, boxing and whatnot, and he had taken the name of Lead when he came over here. Well, pretty soon they were calling him Swede Lee. Well, then he started calling himself a Swede. When I was introduced to him by my brother-in-law, they introduced me to Swede. So, you know, pretty soon, he was Swede.
Yeah. So he finally decided to go ahead and accept the name.
That's what happens. You begin to hear this enough, and pretty soon you start to internalize it. That's who I am. That's who I am. The message and the phrases and words that are used constantly, and pretty soon that's who you think these people are.
But can't you take it and turn it back, too? Don't some black people do that or other?
Don't anybody? Well, no, yes, you can.
No, you take it, and then you it's a negative word, but you appropriate it to yourself and you turn it into a positive thing about yourself.
But what happens to you?
No, I'm trying to think of the example that I'm thinking of. No, I know what you're saying, but it's also a trick you can play on the majority. Mm-hmm.
Maybe an illustration of
like that. I am a dumb Swede and proud of it, sort of thing.
The phrase blank is beautiful.
That's it.
The phrase blank is beautiful is an illustration of that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
But it's also coupled with the idea that minorities always want to change their name. That after a while you get called one name and you don't like that, so you switch to another one, and you're continually trying to reappropriate a better name because that one has bad connotations.
Yes, and that's till the majority decides to affirm.
Yeah.
So they keep changing the name until it's something that finally gets pushed back, and you keep saying it over and over. Like the movement of black power and black is beautiful. It was not saying that white was ugly. It was saying black is beautiful, trying to affirm what it is. And then you keep hearing that enough, then maybe you affirm those people. But that struggle with the name change and who determines the name is also important.
Mm-hmm.
Is something that the majority need to start hearing and listen and revealing more and more. And what you've done is to see how that works. Anyway, this is how we deal with some of the realities in our communities, isn't it?
There's a lot of room for thought.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I see a lot of violence in those names, and it's like those names are the boundary. And it has kind of economic and political power too. It's a exerted force on people.
The language is very powerful, isn't it? Verbs. Mm-hmm. Somebody else have a comment?
Yes. My grandfather was an editor of a Norwegian paper, and in World War I you were required either to get permission from the local postmaster or you had to have every issue censored in English. Which is a terrible imposition. And of course, Norwegians and Swedes and Danes were treated like Germans because basically it's all the same kind of funny foreign language. Mm-hmm. And so they had to have, since he was not a Republican, the postmaster required him to translate everything into English before he could print it. Mm-hmm. So he rapidly decided you couldn't really publish a paper that way. Mm-hmm. And enormous force to get rid of all German culture, because we're fighting the Germans. And so nobody should talk German. You know, sauerkraut was turned into liberty cabbage. All those changes forced on people, you know, because of the hatred that was welling up because of the war.
And did you know in the Continental Congress, the vote on which language to use in our new country was very close. Only one vote decided it, and that was cast by a German Lutheran.
I just thought of the example I was thinking of. It's not racial, it's with a homosexual. We're here, we're queer, get used to it. So they're taking the name.
Okay. She's going to be good in that other workshop on our other session. Okay, how are we doing?
4 minutes left.
4 minutes? Okay. In our brief time here together, we wanted to give you a chance to look at the ways in which our communities have come together, but now we want to step beyond that in these series to look at now what new language, what new ways that we can begin to look at this whole issue of diversity. Because this is, from what you just said, revealing the fact that we don't like difference and the way we deal with difference and things we pick up on these small parts of them and just project it on different groups of people to get rid of it, reject it, etc. So we're going to be summation.
Yes, let me just take a couple of minutes. I want to share something with you. When you go into a large dining room and you see several tables, some with blank places, some with, you know, open chairs, if there's a group of African Americans sitting over here with empty chairs, and maybe one or two empty chairs over here, what would be your inclination?
Go right to the white folks. To be real honest? Yeah. Yeah. Afraid?
Oh, where are you?
Someone would be too comfortable.
Rejection.
Yeah.
Interesting,
is
isn't it?
Else. Yeah,
yes,
not
right.
Repulsion. Rejection. Yeah. Why would they want me to sit with them?
When I was in the fourth grade, living in a little town called Kingman in northwestern Arizona, I recall one of my best friends went on vacation in the summertime, and he and his family went to the south. And when they came back, he was telling me about their trip and how interesting it was. One town they went in, there was a sign on the outskirts of the town. And the sign, I remember exactly what he told me. It says, the sign says, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on you here." Do you remember seeing signs like that?
More descriptive than that.
Yes. Really interesting that our experience of otherness tends to be one of rejection. And one of the ways, of course, we reject otherness is to trivialize it, as some of you pointed out, to minimize it, to make fun of it, or even to become violent. Somebody suggested these terms have violence in them. Now, by Jove, you can jolly well bet that if you were African American and you came into one of those towns and saw that sign, you were not going to be there when the sun went down, unless you were with an army.
Yeah, but it was accepted.
By who?
By the people, by the culture.
Indeed.
Right then it was accepted.
Yes, indeed.
It makes me curious what we're doing right now, yeah, that 20 years from now will,
yeah,
not be accepted.
Yes.
Be,
that's an interesting question.
Isn't,
where we want to spend our time working, really, is the question of how do we move from fragmentation to unity and diversity, or from the melting pot. What was Joseph Barnes' comment about the melting pot?
Yes, he said the melting pot is one from the African American experience. You get burned on the bottom and the scum rises to the top.
He suggested what we need is an image of the stew, you know, where all the parts of the stew remain separate, but their flavors all mingle in the whole. I think maybe you were getting at that a little bit earlier with the pot. Yeah. I want to share with you a little chart called Attitudes Toward Differences, the Riddle Scale. Now, I don't know if you've seen this before. This chart was drawn up particularly in relation to homophobia. But we looked at it and realized that it also spoke to some of our experiences in relation to racial diversity and just the whole issue of diversity.